KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
What you see here is just an assault on our most fundamental rights almost in every single sector.
Taking stock of a sweeping campaign of retribution 100 days into the second Trump administration.
For Tuesday, April 29th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead this hour, the UN has run out of food in Gaza. Children are hungry.
Some children becoming the skeleton because of the malnutrition.
Also, why a Kennedy Center show to mark the anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War was canceled.
And we meet two researchers on a mission to introduce Americans to a more diverse array of seafood.
Americans only know how to eat cod and salmon fillets. We need to teach them how to eat other kinds of fish. And I was like, maybe you're not thinking about the right Americans.
Meanwhile, chicken thighs are rising in popularity and price in the U.S.
So are chicken breasts still king? Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump took office 100 days ago with a big list of campaign promises to fulfill. But according to the latest NPR PBS News Marist National poll, a majority of Americans say they disapprove of the job he's doing as president. Here's NPR's Elena Moore.
When asked to grade Trump on his job so far, a plurality of Americans gave him an F. More than 80% of Democrats feel that way, compared to 5% of Republicans. Among independents, nearly half also gave Trump a failing grade. Michigan independent voter Michael Corwin doesn't go that far. He voted for Trump last fall and puts him in the B range. But he does have reservations, particularly over the economy.
I don't think he's paid as much attention to it as he should have. It feels like it's the same, basically, as when it was Biden. I mean, everything's still kind of expensive.
He's not alone there. 55% of adults say they disapprove of Trump's handling of the economy. Elena Moore, NPR News.
U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, is touting its 100-day enforcement numbers. The agency says it's arrested 66,000 migrants without papers and removed over 65,000. NPR's Jasmine Garst reports on the sharp drop at the southern border.
One of the defining goals of the Trump administration has been a historic campaign of mass deportations. Officials for Immigration and Customs Enforcement say the focus has been on criminals who threaten public safety. They say 3 in 4 of the arrests performed in the first 100 days were immigrants with a criminal record. They also said they've been zeroing in on worksite enforcement, arresting over 1,000 migrants working in the U.S. illegally, and proposing over $1 million in fines against businesses who hire them. In addition, ICE says it has established over 400 new partnerships with local law enforcement so far this year. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
Trump administration federal job cuts are taking a heavy toll on black workers. As NPR's Hansi Luong reports, black people make up a higher share of the federal civilian workforce compared with their share of the population as a whole.
The government's latest public data from September show black people made up about a third or more of the staff at many federal agencies, including the Departments of Education, Treasury, and Housing and Urban Development. Chris Marsh, a sociologist and demographer at the University of Maryland, says the data show the Trump administration's cuts are likely to hurt the Washington, D.C. suburbs in Maryland that federal work has helped turn into the country's two wealthiest majority black counties.
If you're now deciding to shrink the jobs in the federal government, you do understand that one of the consequences is going to be that you're going to be probably shrinking the black middle class. Is that by design, or is that just like a happenstance of what's happening right now?
The White House did not respond to NPR's request for comment. Hansi Luong, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 300 points. This is NPR. The Mellon Foundation's announced $15 million in emergency funding for humanities councils across the country. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, the support comes after the government canceled grants that affected museums, historic sites, book festivals, and other cultural groups.
The Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, cut some $65 million to state humanities councils, money that had already been approved by Congress. In a statement, the Mellon Foundation says, without immediate intervention, many state councils could could close. Mellon's $15 million will go to the Federation of State Humanities Councils, where Phoebe Stein is president.
Some are looking at how they can retain staff. Others are thinking about repurposing programming.
Stein says humanities groups have been talking to Congress about how to restore the funding that was cut by DOGE. Humanities councils work with thousands of local groups in every corner of the country. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News, Washington.
Another survey today showing the confidence of U.S. consumers taking a hit. The nonprofit business research group, the Conference Board, says its Consumer Confidence Index for April fell for a fifth consecutive month, down 7.9 points to its lowest level since May of 2020. The index measures the confidence of consumers down the road. In the latest survey, concerns about the economic impact of Trump administration tariffs continue to cause consumer expectations for future growth to sour. Crude oil futures prices continued their downward slide today. Oil fell $1.63 a barrel to end the session at $60.42 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump campaigned for the White House promising payback.
I am your warrior. I am your justice. And for those who have been wronged and betrayed, I am your retribution. I am your retribution.
Now, 100 days into the second Trump administration, it's become clear that was not just talk. Trump has used government power to target more than 100 people and institutions across American society. As NPR's Tom Dreisbach reports, his targets are already facing the consequences.
To get a sense of President Trump's agenda, take the events of just one day, April 9th.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We just had a
Trump was in the Oval Office holding a black Sharpie. The White House Staff Secretary Will Scharf was handing Trump a set of orders targeting the president's enemies.
And Sussman Godfrey to ensure that they can't access government resources, government buildings, given their previous activities.
Sussman Godfrey is a law firm whose previous activities include suing several Trump allies for defamation.
There were some very bad things that happened with these law firms.
The next target?
The next presidential memorandum we have for you relates to Miles Taylor.
Miles Taylor served in the first Trump administration. He crossed Trump when he anonymously wrote a scathing op-ed that called Trump an amoral agent of chaos.
I think he's guilty of treason, if you want to know the truth, but we'll find out. And I assume we're recommending this to the Department of Justice.
Yes, sir.
Trump kept going.
Terrible guy.
Similarly, sir, Christopher Krebs, the former head of CISA. Yeah.
Christopher Krebs was the top cybersecurity official in the first Trump administration, and Trump fired him for saying the 2020 election was safe and secure. Now, Trump is ordering the government to investigate Krebs, too.
He's the fraud. He's a disgrace. So we'll find out whether or not it was a safe election. And if it wasn't, he's got a big price to pay.
That was all in the span of just 10 minutes in the Oval Office on April 9th. But Trump's retribution agenda started on day one. NPR has found that Trump is using the government to investigate or otherwise punish more than 100 people or institutions, including political opponents, former officials, student protesters, law firms, universities, news organizations, and people who investigated him or his allies.
What you see here is just an assault on our most fundamental rights, almost in every single sector.
Amanda Carpenter is a conservative and a former aide to Senator Ted Cruz. She now works with the nonprofit Protect Democracy and says Trump's actions are about seizing power and punishing anyone who stands in his way.
whether that's the media, whether it's academia, whether it's immigration. Donald Trump is working at a very rapid pace to exercise control and command over that area.
Trump's orders have not all held up, like the order against Sussman Godfrey. A federal judge found that order unconstitutional, saying the country's founders would see it as a shocking abuse of power. But the courts did not protect Sean Brennan. Brennan was a federal prosecutor. He worked on dozens of January 6th cases. On Inauguration Day, Trump issued mass pardons to the January 6th defendants, even the most violent. He said they were treated unfairly. Not long after, Brennan got an email from his new boss at the Justice Department.
I was being terminated specifically for my work on January 6th cases, which it characterized as perpetrating a grave national injustice against the American people.
More than a dozen other January 6th prosecutors were fired. And they don't just face unemployment. The Justice Department is now investigating them, too, for possible unethical or even illegal conduct.
Do you believe you were retaliated against?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything that could be clearer. I was retaliated against for taking actions that were well within the law, but that were politically unfavorable to the people in charge.
Mark Zaid is a private attorney. He's also been on the wrong side of Trump. Back in 2019, Zaid represented an anonymous government whistleblower who filed a complaint that helped lead to Trump's first impeachment. At the time, Trump called Zaid a sleazeball attorney, said he should be investigated for fraud. Now that he's back in office, Trump has issued a White House memo targeting Zaid and revoking his security clearance.
Without any due process, without any notification of why my clearance was revoked.
And without that clearance, Zaid can't work on the national security cases that are his bread and butter. Lawyers and law firms have been some of Trump's top targets. The administration has taken action against more than a dozen firms. They cite the fact that the firms have taken cases on, for example, transgender rights or hired lawyers who previously investigated Trump. And Zaid says there's another reason why Trump is going after lawyers.
Because we are upholding the rule of law. And so long as the court system functions, we can damper, hinder, slow down, if not stop, what he's trying to do.
Some firms have made deals with the administration and agreed to do tens of millions of dollars worth of pro bono work for causes Trump supports. The White House bragged that big law was bending the knee to Trump. A federal judge said those deals amounted to unconstitutional government coercion. Congressman Robert Garcia is a Democrat from California. He says the Trump administration is trying to coerce political opponents, too.
I'm a pretty outspoken member of Congress, and they wanted to silence me.
Garcia's story starts in February, when he went on CNN and said Democrats needed to fight harder against Elon Musk and the Department of Government Efficiency.
And what the American public want is for us to bring actual weapons to this bar fight. This is an actual fight for democracy.
Garcia says he was speaking metaphorically. But Trump's top federal prosecutor in Washington, D.C., Ed Martin, sent Garcia a letter, asked him to clarify his comments within 1 week, adding, quote, "We take threats against public officials very seriously." Just what was your first reaction when you got that letter?
I mean, my first reaction was, this is totally insane. And then immediately I got angry and I thought, you know, Trump's DOJ, the U.S. attorney, should not be using their office to intimidate people and certainly not trying to use the office to silence the opposition.
The Trump Justice Department has gone even further with other Democrats and announced a criminal investigation into the governor and attorney general of New Jersey over immigration policy. Along with political targets, pro-Palestinian students from abroad have been arrested and are fighting deportation. Media outlets the administration dislikes are facing FCC investigation, including NPR. For weeks, we asked the White House for an interview for this story. They did not respond.
Never again will the immense power of the state be weaponized to persecute political opponents.
Publicly, the administration claims that Trump has kept this promise from his inaugural address.
And again, under my leadership, we will restore fair, equal, and impartial justice under the constitutional rule of law.
And when Trump has targeted his political opponents these last 100 days, the administration says it's about accountability. Just last week, the FBI arrested a Wisconsin judge for allegedly obstructing ICE agents. The judge denies the charges. Democrats warn that Trump is trying to intimidate the judiciary. Attorney General Pam Bondi told Fox News that some judges are, quote, deranged, adding, no one is above the law. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
Whether it is baked, fried, bone-in, or whole filet, the way we eat fish actually says a lot about our heritage, community, and how we grew up. NPR's Ari Daniel brings us this audio postcard from Philadelphia.
It's early morning, and I'm in Chinatown at an Asian supermarket in the seafood section. Oh my goodness. A bounty of ocean life lies before me.
Large oysters, squid, mussels, two different kinds of snails.
Talia Young is an environmental scientist at nearby Haverford College. Giant whelks sit in wooden buckets on the floor. There are jellyfish in bins.
I didn't know you could buy razor clams. Oh, lots of different kinds of crabs.
There are all kinds of whole fish on ice as well. Mackerel, flounder, pompano. Young ate a variety of seafood like this growing up. Her family is from China and Hong Kong.
It's hard for me to imagine somebody raised in a Chinese household who is unfamiliar with the idea that you might eat a whole fish or that a whole fish might show up on your table.
The same thing goes for other communities. Young asked her friend and colleague Valerie Irwin to join us today. She used to run a restaurant in Philadelphia that served food from South Carolina and Georgia Low Country, where her grandparents were born. She loves the seafood section of a Chinatown supermarket like this one.
It's hard to buy fish in a regular grocery store. You can't necessarily buy a big variety, and also it's extremely difficult to buy whole fish. And I really only like whole fish.
Because that's how she was raised, within the Black community of Northern Philly.
All the flavors in the skin and the bones.
Meat on the bone and...
Like the same way that a steak has more flavor if it's still on the bone.
The two women look at the back wall where there are 12 tanks with live fish swimming about. Young convinces Irwin to get one.
All right,
let's go look. Come on.
She selects a small fish she says is likely a striped bass.
So he's reaching into the tank and pulling out a live fish with the net.
Is that good?
Yes.
Thank you.
Talia Young has been on a long-time mission to forge a deeper connection between the people of Philly, like Irwin, and their fish. Years ago, at a local seafood conference, Young overheard a fisherman say something about Americans that puzzled her.
Americans only know how to eat cod and salmon fillets. We need to teach them how to eat other kinds of fish. And I was like, maybe you're not thinking about the right Americans.
So in 2017, she co-founded an initiative called Fishadelphia.
We buy fresh seafood directly from small-scale fishermen, and then we distribute it to diverse communities of seafood eaters.
The subscription program will pause in June to allow the team to focus on other ways of building community.
We bring people to the shore to see the ecosystem that the fish come from and to meet the people who harvested them.
To give consumers a better sense of where their fish come from. Meanwhile, behind the counter, the fish is now scaled and gutted.
It's a nice size. It's cute. It's very convenient to come home with a fish that was alive 5 minutes ago and is cleaned.
I'll probably broil it because frying is way too much trouble.
That's exactly how Irwin will end up preparing her fish tonight, broiled with parsley and garlic. The result, she tells me later, is tender and silky. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Mathnasium, whether students are ahead of the curve or need extra support, Mathnasium's goal is to build confidence through personalized math instruction. Learn more at mathnasium.com. From Capital One, with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. For 2 months, Israel has blocked vital supplies from entering Gaza, and the UN has run out of food to distribute. NPR's Aya Betrawi in Dubai and Anas Baba in Gaza report on children suffering under the blockade.
The Patients' Friends Hospital in Gaza City sees around 350 children a day, many of them with acute to severe malnutrition. Their immune systems are weakened and their growth is stunted. It's the only hospital in northern Gaza with a nutrition center. Its director, Dr. Said Salah, says he'd never seen cases of malnutrition in Gaza until this war.
And some children becoming the skeleton because of the malnutrition. But before the war, nobody suffering.
Gaza's health ministry said last week an 11-month-old baby boy is the latest child to die of hunger. His formula ran out. Aid groups say there's tons of food and medicine waiting to enter Gaza, but Israel's blocking it. Babies like 7-month-old Zain are suffering. He's in the hospital in Gaza City. His mother, Wad Adin, says her son weighs around 10 pounds, just about half the average weight for a boy his age. What can I do for him, she says. The hospitals that are supposed to treat him aren't able to. She says she's at a loss for words. Most of Gaza's hospitals have been destroyed in the war, and several clinics for malnourished kids have closed under Israeli displacement orders in recent weeks. This hospital has high-calorie biscuits and therapeutic milk for kids, but its supplies are running out. Adin says she faced famine while pregnant last year. Gaza City was blockaded, and she says she lived off herbs, bread, and macaroni. Dehydrated, she drank brackish water and was hospitalized. Zain was born with a bacterial infection and needed an incubator, but the hospital was raided by Israeli soldiers searching for militants. At just 2 months old, she only had biscuits softened with water to feed him. They call us terrorists, she said of the Israelis. They're the terrorists, she says. Far-right officials in Israel's government say this siege on Gaza is long overdue. They say it's needed to pressure Hamas to return hostages taken in the October 7th attack of
2023.
Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich told an audience in Israel earlier this month, "Read my lips, not a single grain of wheat will enter if it ends up in Hamas's hands." Israel accuses Hamas of diverting aid. The UN says it keeps a chain of custody on all its aid. Dozens of countries are part of hearings this week at the UN's International Court of Justice in The Hague, saying Israel's blockade is illegal and amounts to collective punishment. Israel's called the proceedings shameful and isn't attending. UNICEF spokesman Jonathan Crix says the agency has just weeks of infant formula left to cover a few hundred babies in Gaza.
Our concern is that the number of children who will be affected by acute malnutrition in the coming days, in the coming weeks, is going to become very high.
He says malnutrition can harm young children for life, hurting their cognitive development.
It is not something that can be easily treated.
Not easily treated, he says, on just rice and bread. He says kids need fruits, vegetables, and protein, almost none of which exists in Gaza now. The UN says half of Gaza's population, about 1 million people, are now eating just one meal a day from charity kitchens like this one. But they too are starting to shut down because they've run out of supplies. It makes for chaotic, desperate scenes like this. Here, hundreds of kids and adults wait for hours in the sun, holding out metal pots and empty food cans. The cooked lentils here are all they've got. Aya Betrawi, NPR News Dubai, with Anas Baba in Gaza.
It's been 50 years since the end of the Vietnam War. Hanoi says nearly 200,000 Vietnamese soldiers are still unaccounted for. Some of their families are now calling on the U.S. to help find them. Journalist Na Pham brings us this story.
Em chỉ cần biết là bác em được quy tập về đâu để em đến đó thắp cho bác em một nén hương.
Thanh Nguyễn has never met her uncle Nguyễn Duy Oánh. An army medic, Oánh was killed in action in Thừa Thiên Huế in central Vietnam in 1972, long before Thanh was born. But growing up, Thanh heard so much about him from her family that he was quiet, kind-hearted, and he looked exactly like her father. Oánh's body has never been recovered.
Và những cái gì mà gia đình còn sót lại chỉ là...
All we have is a notice about my uncle's death from the military, and two handwritten letters from him. After the war, our family began searching for my uncle's remains, but so far, we haven't found anything. My aunts have all given up, but I still hope that one day I will find him. I am looking everywhere.
In Vietnam's ancestral worship culture, a person's dead body should be buried in their homeland near the ancestors. Otherwise, the soul will forever be lost and become a wandering ghost enduring eternal suffering. Thanh's biggest dream is to find her uncle's remains one day and to burn incense to bid a proper farewell to him. Nguyễn Xuân Thắng, an architect, has been looking for Vietnamese missing war dead for almost 20 years. Thắng himself has an uncle who was killed in action in 1968 and is still missing. He receives no money from the government, but he says that funding is not the biggest challenge.
Khó khăn nhất là thông tin và nhân chứng thuyết phục họ chia sẻ.
The biggest difficulty is information and witnesses. Until now, we rely a great deal on people who saw the fighting and what they remember. But their memories are dwindling, and they themselves are passing away. Burial sites have also been removed because of economic development.
After battles, the bodies of killed soldiers, often just pieces of burned flesh and bones, were gathered and buried all together in mass graves. But even after they were excavated, the identification was difficult because, unlike the Americans, Vietnamese soldiers were not issued identification tags. A national committee was only set up 2 years ago to consolidate and lead the searches. But results have been limited due to the lack of resources, both in locating and identifying the remains. There have also been complaints about red tape and corruption.
Order! Order!
On April the 19th, the remains of four American soldiers missing in action, or MIAs, were repatriated in a ceremony in the central city of Da Nang. The U.S. government has spent millions of dollars to look for their missing personnel from the war. In Vietnam, families of missing soldiers often wage their own campaigns with the help of their communities. Some, including Thanh, are now calling on the U.S. to step in because of its involvement in the war.
The war ended a long time ago, but the pain remains. I think the U.S. government should look at this issue and help the Vietnamese people find closure of the painful past.
Since Vietnam and the U.S. normalized their relations in 1995, many American veterans have returned to hand over artifacts and documents. Nguyễn Xuân Thắng says it offered a much-appreciated, albeit delayed, consolation to some families, but many are still waiting. For NPR News, I'm Na Pham in Ho Chi Minh City.
This is NPR News.
President Trump finished 100 days in office. What does Steve Bannon see for the next 100?
There's going to be a confrontation. I think the convergence, particularly of spending cuts and the simultaneously constitutional crisis that we're hurtling to, is going to make this summer a summer like no other.
A longtime Trump ally, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Mark Carney is keeping his job as Prime Minister of Canada.
Canadians just voted in an election completely dominated by Donald Trump.
A lot of this election really came down to who was going to protect Canada the best from the perceived bully of the United States.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Negotiations between the U.S. and its trading partners are ongoing. They're intended to avoid some of the steep tariffs President Trump announced, then paused earlier this month. NPR's Tamara Keith tells us Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent is putting a positive spin on the economic uncertainty.
And to help these automakers bring their factories home as rapidly as possible, I've just signed an executive order to give partial tariff rebates to any company that assembles its cars right here in the U.S.
President Trump has celebrated the 100th day of his second term, yet spent much of his rally marking it in a campaign mode, fixated on past grudges and grievances. Trump and his Democratic predecessor, Joe Biden, he pointed out in Tuesday's rally, attacking Biden's mental acuity once again, and even how he appears in a bathing suit. Trump again uttered the lie that he won the 2020 presidential election during his rally today in Michigan. The White House says President Trump will sign executive orders to relax some of his 25% tariffs on automobiles and auto parts here in the U.S. It's a significant reversal as the import taxes threaten to hurt domestic manufacturers here. Automakers and independent analysts have indicated that the tariffs could raise prices, reduce sales, and make U.S. production less competitive worldwide. Residents of a small central Illinois city are mourning the loss of three children and a teenager who were killed in a startling vehicle collision in a building that hosts a popular after-school camp. Authorities say it appears the crash Monday in which a car barreled through the building in Chatham was not a targeted attack. Illinois State Police say the 44-year-old driver is not in custody. She was not injured, but was taken to a hospital for evaluation, and toxicology reports are still pending. Americans' confidence in the economy slumped for the fifth straight month to the lowest level since the onset of COVID, as worries about the impact of tariffs take a heavy toll on consumer expectations for the economic future. The Conference Board said today that its consumer confidence index fell nearly 8% in April to its lowest reading since May 2020. On Wall Street, stocks finished higher as many U.S. companies report their corporate earnings this week. The Dow gained 300 points, up about 0.75%. This is NPR News. Superman already has a lot of on his shoulders these days. It seems unfair to add the fate of the summer movie season to his list, but he's not alone. Marvel Studios is also returning to theaters in a big way with two movies this summer, Thunderbolts and The Fantastic Four: First Steps. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Few things in life are certain, but for decades in American supermarkets, one thing was chicken thighs were cheaper than chicken breasts. That seems to be changing. It's something Sarah Zhang noticed on a recent trip to the grocery store. She is a science writer at The Atlantic, so she decided to look into it. And what she found is that America's era of white meat as king might be coming to an end. Sarah Zhang, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Talk to me about that era. When did this actually begin, America's obsession with breast meat?
Yeah, well, if you think about going back decades, right, eating a chicken basically meant eating a whole chicken because there was no way for you to get something like six chicken breasts on the dinner table. By the 1980s, the first sort of deboned chicken breast plant opened, and this really kicked off the white meat era. And you might remember, you know, this was also a time when people were really worried about high fat and high cholesterol. So white meat kind of became the healthy option. And, you know, chicken McNuggets were all white meat. And if you wanted to get a dinner, you would get like a grilled chicken breast. And so for a long time, like the rise of white meat really drove the expansion of the chicken industry. It's how chicken got so popular, period.
And how specifically American a trend was this? Because I know a lot of cultures all over the world prefer dark meat. I know a lot of chefs here in the U.S. will tell you that dark meat tastes better.
Yeah, exactly. So for a long time, basically, American chicken producers, they were producing white meat for the U.S. and then exporting the dark meat to other countries. So especially people in the industry used to talk about making their money on the front half of the chicken and losing money on the back half. And then something happened, which was that we started to not just sell like bone-in, skin-on chicken thighs, but actually selling boneless, skinless chicken thighs, which are a lot more similar to the breast meat that, you know, we're kind of used to.
And when did that change come about?
So I was sort of surprised about this because I didn't really grow up eating boneless, skinless chicken thighs. And that's because they didn't really exist.
Right.
They weren't only widely available about 20 years ago.
Right.
And part of this is actually a technology story. So, you know, I've deboned a chicken thigh before and I find it really annoying. But actually, when you automate the process, and the process has become like increasingly automated, machines are really, really good at it. And that's because if you think about what happens, there's really only one bone in the thigh. You know,
yeah.
It's actually a lot easier to get that bone out than to get meat off of a breast. And so this has just become more popular. You know, as you say, chefs kind of always knew that thighs were tastier. It's harder to overcook, you know, it doesn't get dry as easily, has a little bit more fat and a little bit more flavor. So it's just become a lot more popular.
To the point that is central to your article about chicken thighs costing more, I read that and I wondered, it feels like everything costs more. I mean, eggs, for example, is it eggs? Is it every part of the chicken is just costing more because of bird flu and other factors?
Yeah, well, everything is costing more as we unfortunately have lived through the past few years. But if you went back something like, you know, 10, 15 years ago, thighs cost almost half as much as a chicken breast. And now they either cost the same or close to the same or just, you know, a little bit more. So it's the comparative of the chicken breast and the chicken thighs has really changed.
Huh. Are you team dark meat or team white meat?
I knew I was going to get this question. I feel like my nuanced answer is it depends on what you're eating. If I'm getting fried chicken,
right,
I definitely want that crispy chicken thigh with the skin. If I'm putting some, you know, chicken on my salad, want to poach chicken breast, that's what I prefer.
Maybe we should all go back to that era you described at the very beginning of just the whole chicken, throw it in the oven and eat it all.
Yeah, they all have their virtues, every part.
That is Sarah Zhang talking with us about her new story in The Atlantic, The End of Chicken Breast Dominance. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Canadian voters have chosen Mark Carney as prime minister in what is seen as one of the most remarkable elections in Canada in decades. Much of the race has been centered on which candidate can best handle President Trump and his unpredictable policies, something that Carney referred to in his victory speech.
President Trump is trying to break us so that America can own us. That will never ever happen.
Trump has yet to congratulate Carney, a political newcomer. Carney defeated an opponent whose policies mirror President Trump's. The victory caps a remarkable turnaround for Carney's Liberal Party, which, until a few months ago, seemed destined for the political dust heap. NPR's international affairs correspondent Jackie Northam has this report.
Canada's election came down to a race between two people, Prime Minister Mark Carney and the leader of the Conservative Party, Pierre Poilievre. But it was a third figure, President Trump, that defined the tone, the strategy, and ultimately the outcome of the election.
A lot of this election really came down to who was going to protect Canada the best from the perceived bully of the United States.
Jamie Tronis heads up the Center for North American Prosperity and Security, a project of the Macdonald Laurier Institute, a Canadian think tank. She says Trump impacted the election by imposing some tariffs and threatening more, which could tip the country into a recession, and by threatening to make Canada the 51st state.
A lot of Canadians took that very seriously, and even those who didn't take it seriously were certainly offended.
Carney presented himself as the guy who can stand up to Trump. He's had a long career in the financial world, on Wall Street, as governor of the Bank of England during the Brexit turmoil and the Bank of Canada during the economic crisis in 2008. Charles Bird with Earnscliffe Strategies, a public affairs firm in Canada, says Carney reminded voters of that time.
Mr. Carney said very early in the campaign that, you know, when things are good, you probably don't want me. It's when things are in a state of crisis that I'm at my best. And there's no doubt, just given what might be coming vis-a-vis the imposition of tariffs, that we are in a time of crisis.
But Carney also struck a pugilistic stand, coining the phrase elbows up, an ice hockey term for fight back. Bird says Carney's overall message was he's the guy who can take on Trump.
Mark Carney might as well have been sent by central casting in terms of his experience, his credentials, his ability to meet the moment. And there's little doubt that Canadians looked at him and said very early on, this is the guy.
Well, Trump helped Carney's campaign. It hurt Conservative leader Poilievre's chances. For more than a year, the Conservative Party was 20-plus points ahead of the Liberals in the polls. But once Trump started threatening and taunting Canada, voters were increasingly put off by Poilievre's rhetoric and policies about slashing big government, ending wokeism, and the like. At a Carney election celebration, Norman Felix, a truck driver, said Poilievre rubbed him the wrong way.
I think that Poilievre lacks the ability to communicate without sneering.
Poilievre lost his parliamentary seat, which he'd held for 20 years. But the Conservatives put in a good showing, and the final count between the Liberals and the Conservatives was close. The Liberals were four seats short of a majority, so Carney will have a coalition government. Jamie Tronis says he has his work cut out for him.
Mark Carney now has the responsibility to turn around an economy that's facing the first major threat of its lifetime from the United States. And it's a really hard time to try and convince investors to get things going in Canada when they're facing such uncertainty.
But then Carney works well in a crisis. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Some 22% of people in the U.S. ages 5 and older speak a language other than English at home. For parents who are short on time and already keeping multiple plates spinning, raising a child bilingually can feel like an additional hurdle. For NPR's Life Kit, Julia Furlan talked to experts who say that raising kids bilingually does not have to be expensive or exhausting.
Cinco.
Cinco.
Dez.
Sete.
Watching my toddler speak English and Portuguese somehow blows my mind every time. But aside from being cute, there's actually a whole laundry list of benefits to being bilingual, according to Farwa Hussein, who's a bilingual speech pathologist who speaks Hindi, Urdu, and English.
First of all, it's so fun to be able to speak another language.
Hussein says that there are also improvements in cognitive function.
There are better problem-solving skills, and actually research says it delays the onset of dementia as well if you are bilingual.
The study that Hussein is citing says that being bilingual may delay the onset of dementia by up to 5 years. Though I should say that the results are inconclusive when it comes to learning a language much later in life. So let's talk about what it takes to raise multilingual kids. Liliana Diaz is a bilingual speech pathologist who works in Spanish and English. Diaz says it's actually pretty simple.
It's consistency and exposure and practice. So it's all about just practice, 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 and exposing your little one to it as well, too.
She also says that there's no one way to do it.
You know, it's going to be different in every family, and that's okay. That's totally fine. No bilingual is the same. Like, there literally will not be a bilingual person that is the same as the next. So it's totally fine, is usually what I tell parents.
So let's go through some of the most common techniques. There's one parent, one language, which is what I do with my kid, Leo. I speak to her in Portuguese, and my spouse, Steph, speaks to her in English. There's also minority language at home. Time and place is another way to do it. Here's Hussein again.
You block the day, where in the mornings, maybe you're speaking one language, then you're speaking another.
The last of these techniques is called multiple languages at home, which is pretty self-explanatory. It may sound confusing, but really, it's not a problem.
Children are wonderfully resilient, and they will start picking up on how you are providing them that input. And they are so great at being able to tease apart the ways and the languages together.
And while we're on the topic of confusion, before we go, I have to bust one common myth here. I dug into the research and I spoke to experts, and if there's one thing you need to know, it's this.
That myth of bilingualism creating a language delay is totally false.
This idea is so prevalent, but the research just doesn't back it up. Hussein sees it all the time, where parents are worried that being multilingual will somehow set a child back.
What research says is when the child acquires both those languages, they're at age level with their monolingual peers.
Bilingualism isn't a burden that you're adding to your life. It's actually a key that unlocks entirely new worlds. As a parent, you don't always know you're doing the right thing. But watching my kid connect with her cousins on FaceTime or sing a song my grandmother used to love, it feels really nice. For NPR News, I'm Julia Furlan.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. We'll be right back.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. 50 years ago this week, the Vietnam War ended with the fall of Saigon. It was a long and brutal conflict that killed tens of thousands of Americans and more than 3 million Vietnamese. The trauma of war often extends to the children of survivors. Philippa Hughes is one of them. Until recently, she was working with the Kennedy Center's Social Impact Division. She was planning a live event to commemorate the end of the war, but it did not go on as scheduled. NPR's Elizabeth Blair picks up the story.
The event Philippa Hughes planned was a cabaret-style show called Saigon by Night. It was inspired by a direct-to-video variety show made by and for the Vietnamese diaspora beginning in the 1980s called Paris by Night.
I remember my mom watching them, and she would have little watch parties. If you mention Paris by Night to any Vietnamese person, they will 100% recognize what it is. So we wanted to do sort of a tribute to that, but kind of a contemporary take on it to show, you know, where we're at 50 years later. Like, look at all these amazing artists creating things in all these different realms.
Those realms include dance, poetry, and comedy.
My name is Leo Nguyen. I'm from Vietnam. Wow, bro, I can smell the fish sauce from here.
Singer Jess Nguyen planned a version of one of the most popular songs from Paris by Night.
Bang, bang, you shot me down. Bang, bang, I hit the ground. Bang, bang, let off the sound. Bang, bang, my baby shot me down.
Jess Nguyen's parents were children in Vietnam during the war. They moved to the U.S. in the 90s.
The thing about the marking of the end of the war, it doesn't explicitly mark the end to the trauma. There was environmental devastation. There were a lot of bombs that stayed in Vietnam that were undetonated that kids had to watch out for. There was so much grief following. So my parents did experience the war in that way, but not as people who were directly fighting in it.
Saigon by Night was intended as both a tribute to the Vietnamese who suffered during the war and had to leave their homeland, and a celebration of Vietnamese resilience. The show was scheduled for April 19th at the Kennedy Center. But after President Trump took over the center, Hughes says a staff member asked her if she would eliminate or modify a drag performance.
I declined to remove or modify the performance. And then the next thing I knew, the performance was listed as canceled by artists.
Hughes says she did not cancel the show.
I wanted to showcase Vietnamese American artists on the Kennedy Center stage. So it feels hurtful that they would say, I would want to cancel it. They canceled it.
The Kennedy Center did not respond to NPR's request for comment.
All of these actions are so fueled by this fear of the unknown, you know, and that kind of solidifies into hate. And the art of drag is such the opposite of that.
Anthony Lay is the artist who was scheduled to perform in drag, which is partly the story of him coming out to his parents. They escaped Vietnam in 1975. He says they never talked to him about the war.
I just didn't know if it was my place to ask, but if you don't know where you come from, that's a big hole in your spirit and who you are. So I think me sharing more about me being queer, it really opened up this like give and take of sharing and vulnerability. So they began to open up about their journey, and I was able to ask the questions I've always wanted to ask, and we've become much closer since that.
I just care so deeply about our personal relationships with one another.
Philippa Hughes says one of the reasons for that is watching how the war devastated Vietnam and her family. She's known for bringing people together. Since 2016, she's hosted a series of dinners in which she invites Republicans and Democrats to break bread together.
A lot of our polarization today can be directly traced back to the war in Vietnam. And I want to repair the social fabric of our country through connection and relationships.
And it's through those relationships that Philippa Hughes found another venue for Saigon by Night after it was dropped from the Kennedy Center. The show is rescheduled for the fall. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
In Portland, Oregon, on the last Friday of every month, volunteers pass out treats to bikers to help them along their commute. This ritual has been happening for 20 years with no sign of slowing down. Reporter Dina Prichep showed up for the group's latest feast.
It's Friday morning, and there's a deluxe spread laid out on folding tables on Portland's Blumenauer Bridge.
We've got a French press straw head, coffee, donuts, pancakes, bacon, all of the above.
Thank you.
Lance Poehler woke up at 6 a.m. to brew 5 gallons of coffee. He and his fellow volunteers have set up a breakfast station on the sidewalk entrance to the bridge. Mugs and plates and electric griddles to sizzle pancakes, all hauled here by bike, of course. Some of the cyclists and pedestrians who stop by are on their way to work. Some are having a leisurely morning. And all are delighted, including Ian Lindsay, currently enjoying a chocolate coconut donut.
The first time, we were doing our normal bike ride, and suddenly there was a tent full of donuts. We were like, what is going on?
Lindsay has been stopping by since his daughter Marin was a kindergartner strapped into a bike seat. Now she's 8 years old, riding her own bike.
Well, when we first started coming here, there was coffee and, like, milk. And then we came along and they saw that there was kids coming all the time. So now they have orange juice and they have donuts and now they're adding pancakes, which I'm loving.
While kids like Marin bike off to school, retirees like Robin Jensen stay for over an hour to enjoy the breakfast and the vibes.
Just really wonderful. It's a really nice community, meeting new people. I mean, look at this feast.
Breakfast on the Bridges started over 20 years ago as part of a summer bike festival. It was such a hit that volunteers decided to make it a monthly event. They've now served thousands of cups of coffee on multiple Portland bridges. Timo Forsberg has been there since the beginning.
If you ask somebody, how was your commute into work today in a car, how many people are going to say, I had the greatest time? Maybe 1 out of 1,000. If you ask somebody who rode their bike, it's probably going to be 9 out of 10, maybe 10 out of 10.
Forsberg works for Portland's Bureau of Transportation and has volunteered for breakfast on the bridges in the past. He says bike lanes and other infrastructure make cycling safe, but events like this make it more fun.
Doing breakfast on the bridge is great because people just walk up and talk to you. And there was this one time when there was a very attractive young woman who came up and just started talking to me, and we were chatting, and I'm like, this is very strange. I don't know why she's doing this, but now we're married. So breakfast on the bridge brought me a happy wife, a happy life.
But even if you don't meet the love of your life, you can end up with a nice bike ride and a pretty great breakfast. For NPR News, I'm Dina Prichep on the Blumenauer Bridge in Portland, Oregon.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, working to shorten the gap between cancer research and cancer care. Learn more about Dana-Farber's Momentum of Discovery at DanaFarber.org/everywhere. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.